Welcome to Take Notes, S&P Global Ratings Structured Finance Podcast and the credit event of your day. Tune in as your hosts, Jim Manzi and Tom Schopflocker, explore hot topics across the structured finance and global markets.
Hello and welcome to Take Notes. I'm your host, Tom Schopflocker. Today, our topic concerns the fact that a sizable portion of the American population is saddled with student loan debt, and this is making it difficult for them to participate in the economy. Student loan debt outstanding in the U.S. has now surpassed $1.6 trillion. To put that into context, credit card debt is just a little over $1 trillion, and the auto loan debt is just under $1.2 trillion. So it sounds like the student loan debt issue is a problem indeed, without an obvious solution. My guest in the studio today is ABS analyst John Anglim, who will help shed some light on this topic. To start off, John, could you give us a brief overview of the history of the student loan market?
Yes, the student loan market has grown considerably over the years. That is a function of the cost of education rising much faster than people's incomes. So parents have had to work with their students and get loans to bridge the gap between the cost of education and the funds available to pay for the education.
Okay, and so we hear about government student loan debt and private loan student debt. Help me disambiguate this. What's the difference between these in terms of how much is outstanding of this $1.6 trillion? What's the breakdown?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the federal student loan product is administered through the direct lending program. Back prior to 2010, there was also a FFELP student loan program that was a government program. But the student loan debt that's out there, the $1.6 trillion, is predominantly federal student loans. There's a very small portion, maybe $200 billion or so, of private student loans. But the lion's share of student loans is federal student loans.
And in terms of underwriting, what's the difference between how the government student loans are underwritten and how the private student loans are underwritten?
Yeah, so the federal student loans are trying to achieve a purpose of allowing people to attend colleges and universities or achieve higher education goals. So the idea behind the federal student loan program was to not have underwriting, but to provide access to higher education through a funding of a loan. The private student loan space is like a typical consumer loan where a bank or a lender will do underwriting, and if you don't qualify for the loan, you don't get the loan.
So in terms of the quality of the loans, in terms of performance, one might expect then that the private student loan market performs better?
Oh, well, that's definitely the case. So the private student loan space today is primarily targeting parents. Most of the products are cosigned type products, upwards of 90, 95%. Some of the lenders, it's 100% cosigners to parents who have established income levels. As opposed to the federal program, the loans are predominantly to students, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are in school, don't necessarily have income. So it's more of a trying to promote higher education and trying to fund it to be able to allow kids to go to school.
Now, one hears a lot about refinancing and refi companies. What exactly is their role in the student loan market?
So the student loan, the federal student loan program has interest rates that are typically around 7%, which is good for someone that's doesn't really have a lot of credit in the credit bureau. But as the students become older and still have student loan debt and they get into their 30s and now they're making a decent income and they've been employed for 7, 8, 10 years, from a credit bureau standpoint, some of these obligors are really strong candidates, 780 FICOs, higher 800 FICOs. So the lenders are able to offer these type of borrowers lower interest rates because they qualify because of their strong credit quality. So the refinance companies saw an opportunity to access some of these federal student loan borrowers who were really strong credits and offer them a lower interest rate and help them refinance their federal student loan debt into a lower interest rate.
Now, John has recently co-authored a paper called The Problem with Student Loan Forgiveness for All, and it's available on our website, www.spglobal.com/SF Research. And in that paper, John, you give a breakdown of who owes how much debt. Can we discuss that now?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways to slice this, but I like to slice it in terms of the number of borrowers and how much the individuals they owe. So 35% of the number of borrowers owe less than $10,000 on their student loan. So that's more than a third of the number of borrowers owe less than $10,000. So just doing the math, a $10,000 loan at 7% interest rate, 10-year loan, is about $116 a month. That would be the monthly payment. So there's a lot of borrowers who don't have very large balances. On the flip side, there are a small amount, the number is about 14% of the number of borrowers owe more than 50% of the debt. They actually owe 52% of the debt. So there's a smaller number of borrowers that have very large balances. So 9% of the borrowers owe more than $80,000. So I think this is important because how you would try to work with a borrower who owes $80,000, that individual is probably very interested in a reduced interest rate, something to make the payment a little more affordable, as opposed to someone who owes less than $10,000 or the 17 or 18% that owe less than $5,000. Those folks owe monthly payments of like $60 or $110. That's in most cases less than what their monthly phone bill is. So again, attacking those two types of borrowers should use different strategies.
Now let's talk about these two types of borrowers. I understand the completion rate for a college degree in the U.S. is only about 50%. That is, that half the students who start a degree don't actually finish it. Yet, I imagine many of these students took out student loan debt. Which of these two groups, if either, do these students fall into, the ones who don't complete?
Yeah, the non-completers typically have low balances because they didn't finish their sophomore year, or they didn't go do a junior year or a senior year, or they didn't do graduate school. So they're the ones that have the lower balances. And the default rate on the lower balances are usually three or four times the level of the people that have the higher balances. And again, this is all kind of not rocket science. The people that weren't able to finish college or didn't find the motivation to get through college, their ability to access a higher income level is a little more limited. There's a lot of data around this. The people that go to school longer and get higher degrees typically are able to access jobs that pay more. And those folks tend to be better payers, and the data definitely supports that.
Okay, and let's tie this back to asset-backed securities. After all, you are an ABS analyst. The securitization utilization rate for student loans has fallen from almost 40% before the crisis to just over 10% at the moment. Why is that?
Right. So the FFELP student loan had a guarantee associated with default. So that's valuable to investors. And so that product was being securitized up till it was originated up until 2010. There's still some supply of FFELP loans that get securitized every once in a while. But since it stopped originating in 2010, there isn't as much. As opposed to the direct lending program, it's not a loan product that has any kind of guarantee. So at this point, it's not something that could be securitizable because it would have very high defaults that would not be very attractive from an investor perspective.
So clearly there's an affordability issue with education in the United States. The growth of wages has not kept up with the price of a university education, and students are forced to take out loans, which will impact how they spend their money for the beginning of their adult life, and in some cases, for all of their adult lives. It's been much talked about in the media how this will affect the economy in so much as consumers are, because of their student loan debt loads, unable to buy houses, buy cars, and other goods. And some politicians have proposed that a solution would be to simply forgive the debt. And they claim that the growth in GDP would eventually offset the cost of forgiving the debt. And this is what you address in your recent paper that you wrote with Mark O'Neill. Why don't you tell us about that now, and also maybe explain what some of the unintended consequences would be if indeed the government were to forgive all student loan debt?
I certainly think that the student loan borrowers that would benefit from any kind of forgiveness plan would love to see that happen. I think the solution is really the question. The problem isn't that people have the debt. The problem is that higher education costs are outpacing just about everything. Forgiving the student loan debt doesn't fix that problem. Even creating free public schools doesn't address the cost of education at private schools, which is very high, and that's where a lot of people go to school in the United States. So it would almost seem that you give everyone a free card for their student loan debt, and then we start ramping up right away again. So I don't really see that as a solution.
So what you're saying is this isn't a solution to the problem per se, it's more of a Band-Aid, and it'll stop the bleeding temporarily, but then the problem will start up again. But one thing that's possibly a greater concern is that there may be externalities in the sense that if you forgive everyone their debt, it masks the behavior of these non-payers. So how would that affect the economy?
Yeah, that's definitely the case too, at least in my opinion. The beautiful thing about credit analysis is if you track people's behavior and you have history on how consumers behave, then that should help lenders make good decisions on where they lend their money. And when you have data around student loans and you choose to erase it all and pay everybody's debt off, remember what we said earlier, there are payers and non-payers. That's important information to lenders. If you pay everybody's debt off, now you don't have payers and lenders from a history standpoint. You have a whole bunch of everybody paid off their loan. And that they all look the same, and they're not all behaving the same today. So that would not be good for lenders going forward if all of that information was completely erased and it made everyone look as though they were all payers.
Right. So that when this money gets pumped back into the economy and people start buying houses and cars, the problem is that some of them might not pay off the loans that they acquired to buy these houses and cars.
Yeah, you may see the same issues with delinquencies and defaults that we have in student loan space pop up in other areas, and it's because the lenders wouldn't have been able to benefit from the information that is erased by the repayment of everyone's student loan.
So it sounds to me like the notion of forgiveness is clearly popular with people who are saddled with student loan debt, but maybe it's more of a headline grabber, something that makes politicians attractive, something that will be popular with certain segments of the population, but aren't viable in the long term because of the fact that they don't get at the root cause. Is this correct?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we'd be better off having people focus on some of the other things that are helping support people that have student loan debt. So things like income share agreements and college repayment benefits, income-based repayment plans. These are things that are helping people try to manage their student loan debt. The notion of the government being able to get to a point of forgiving all student loan debt doesn't seem to be likely, given that even the public service forgiveness plan that they had put out 10 years ago is stumbling along 10 years later, as 99% of the people that are applying for funding are being turned down. So I agree, it seems more like a headline grabber and not necessarily something that's practical and will get done in the future.
So when I went to university in Montreal many years ago, the cost of tuition was much, much lower than the numbers you hear thrown about today. And even now, a Canadian education costs far less than a U.S. education. So I wonder, has there been any discussion about the adoption of practices that are used in other countries? Canada, for example, the U.K., where tuition across the board for higher education is much lower.
Well, there have been some reports that compared and contrasted what's done here in the U.S. and what's done in other countries. And then I think the big difference from a very high level is that there's a notion of fairness around repaying a student loan that could be attached to your income level. And whether that's a percentage of your income or whatever the program might be, but it's about fairness and what's fair for someone who owes $5,000 worth, what's fair for someone who owes $150,000 in student loans. And I think there could be a lot of work done around that type of an approach as opposed to just having the government fund a bailout for everybody.
I'd like to thank my guest, John Anglim, for joining me in the studio today. Join us next time on Take Notes.
To subscribe to Take Notes or to view our analyst research, go to spratings.com/structuredfinance. Thanks for listening to Take Notes with Jim Manzi and Tom Schopflocker.